about 1:30. Present are Representatives Gruenberg, Taylor, Cotton, and Son Chair. Today we have before us House Bills 43, 28, and 61. 114 is on the calendar. It's going to be held over till Thursday. Till Wednesday, I guess. Okay. Also note, Representative Ulmer is with us. So, Representative Donnelly, you want to join us at the end of the table? It's your bill. Note for the committee, there is no meeting tomorrow. We will meet on Wednesday and Thursday to pick up whatever bills we have from last week and this week, and possibly Friday if it takes to move some of the legislation. Also note, Representative Navar is with us. Representative Donnelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 43 is a piece of legislation that amends an existing statute that requires employers when they pay for the transportation of a worker to a work site that they provide them with return transportation to provide that. One, the employer give notice of that right to return transportation, and two, when that point of hire is outside the state of Alaska, that they provide transportation back to a location agreed upon or the place of hire, whether or not they finance the transportation to Alaska. There are several proposed amendments before the committee. Two are proposed by the Department of Labor. Currently, in existing statute, there is no statute of limitations regarding this right. So if you paid for somebody to come to Alaska and 20 years later they wanted to go back, you'd still be obligated pursuant to the statute to provide their transportation home. The original bill has a one-year statute of limitations on that, and the proposal from the Department of Labor is for 2 years. I think that's very reasonable. I think that's a good idea. I'm happy to have that change. Secondly, I'm asking that we adopt some language deleting one amendment that was made in the Labor and Commerce Committee, which concerns requiring the state to comply with this statute. Currently, the information we've received since we made that amendment was that the state already provides this return transportation to its for people it employs, and those few very rare cases where it doesn't, it's de minimis, the effect. So there is a zero fiscal note with the legislation. I believe there was one other proposal from the Department of Labor, which is in their new position paper, which I also agree with the second proposed amendment. If I could find a copy of their position paper. Right. Which would provide, just through a clarification, currently in the statute, the way the Department of Labor has been enforcing it is that there's a portion of the statute that says the return transportation shall take effect to a place agreed upon by the parties. The way Labor has interpreted that over the years, and I guess this law has been on the books since 1949, is that that would be agreed upon at the completion of the employment period. That prevents coercion on the part of the employer to say to the employee ahead of time, if you don't agree that the transportation or waive your right to transportation or agree that it shall be to this particular location, we're not going to hire you. So Labor would like some clarification in that to provide that it's specifically in statute that that agreed place would that agreement would take place at the termination of employment contract. The final proposed amendment is contained in my memorandum to the committee, which is tries to deal with the any potential constitutional questions that this legislation may inspire by changing the focus of the return, or the place of the return, away from the place of an individual employee's residency to that place where the employee was sighted, the location that employee was in at the time of hire, thus removing the residency clause entirely and basing the statute based on the point of fire. Thank you.
I've got a couple of questions. Maybe we could use some examples to get through this. Starting with the last one on the agreement to employ to hire, How does it work where a person calls up an employer from outside of the state and sends a resume in or something, and they agree, they talk on the telephone that that person should come to work, and he arrives, I guess, in state and goes to work. Is there, this bill here says that within 1 year, if that person quits or something, then you have to pay their way back to wherever they were?
Mr. Chairman, this proposal makes no changes in the existing law that would be applicable to the scenario you just outlined. So it's probably more appropriate for Department of Labor to respond to that as to how they're interpreting and enforcing the existing law. This legislation wouldn't change that.
Okay, let's take a firm, and if I can remember the scenario, it came up, it's the Dutch Harbor syndrome, right? Let's just say there's a firm at Dutch Harbor that says, we're going to hire out of Anchorage. That's our hiring point. We're going to provide transportation to and from Dutch, from Anchorage to Dutch Harbor, and when you're done, back to Anchorage. But the people who are coming from Utah or wherever you want to, I don't know, someplace else. So they said, when you get to Anchorage, we'll hire you, we'll fly you to Dutch, and when it's over, we'll fly you back to Anchorage. Now, how does this bill impact that? Is there a, are we putting in that they have to fly them all the way back to Dubuque, Iowa?
This legislation would make...
I mean, they've said the hiring point is Anchorage.
Okay. It would depend on the Department of Labor's current interpretation of where the point of hire is. So this legislation wouldn't change their current definitions or their current application of that. So I defer to the Department of Labor to describe how they're currently enforcing the law and how it would in turn be applicable to your particular scenario that you're asking.
One more point here before I take a lot of questions. I was reading somewhere in your material where the parties could agree prior to employment where the transportation be to and from. Where in the bill is it?
Under existing law, one of the criteria is the return transportation shall take place to, and one of the listed places is a point agreed upon by the parties. What this would do is explain that agreement would take place. The proposed amendments from the Department of Labor would put in the statute their understanding of how they've been interpreting that, is that point, that the time of that agreement would could only take place at the end of this period of employment and not at the beginning.
Okay. Is there any other questions of the committee? Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, Representative Donnelly, just a it's a really a technical thing. The second portion of the amendment here, actually it's really two amendments, one which has two different things in it and one which is the definition. With the thing on page 2, line 4, it says delete the word resided and insert the word cited. I think that that doesn't make grammatical sense. I think it would have to be the person was cited outside the state, or maybe was located or something. I just ask you to double check that particular term.
Sure.
Because it doesn't make sense.
If I can find a copy of the original bill here.
I have the original. You need the original day?
Yeah.
Here's the original.
I think that'd be appropriate.
Well, what should it be?
Your change was cited.
Is
cited.
Usually you don't say somebody is, quote, cited. You'd say is located or something like
that's
that. You might check with the drafter.
If you were going to shoot him, you'd say we're cited.
We did look it up in the dictionary, and it means the location where they're at that particular time.
So maybe the drafters can take a look at the language.
Representative Barnes, you're here for the record, and I'll see if you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Donnelly, I was going through the different position papers, and the one that came out of your office dated February the 16th, you state the Department of Labor in their position paper asked that HB 43 be amended to provide an agreement about the return transportation made prior to the employment. Do you have a amendment prepared?
Representative Barnes, in the Department of Labor's position paper, there's an amendment prepared for that.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
I believe it's in a position paper from Labor dated February 13th, 1987, and it's on page 2 at the bottom. I think there's some amendments from Labor. Representative Cotton.
I'm looking at the same letter, and where you discuss the three major changes. Number 3 entitles employees to return transportation if they were recruited from outside of state, regardless of whether their transportation to the state was paid by their employer. So that sort of reminds me of the chairman's question. And so you're saying that, I mean, I'm not sure what the change is in. What change are you proposing?
Representative Cotton, the chair. The change is at the current time, employers are only obligated to provide return transportation if they pay for the transportation to Alaska. The change is that whether or not they pay the transportation to Alaska, they will still be obligated to pay the transportation back.
So why don't you give an example of that then?
Australia.
We'll just run through.
If I was an employer and I recruited, Seattle, and I had an office in Seattle, and I hired somebody for a job in Alaska in Seattle, under existing law, if I didn't pay for their way to Alaska, I wouldn't be obligated to pay the return transportation to Seattle. Under the bill that's before you, it would change the existing law to provide that if I hired somebody in Seattle for work in Alaska, even if I didn't pay their transportation to Alaska, I would still be obligated to offer them return transportation to Seattle.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Taylor and then Representative Barnes.
Kind of follow up on Representative Cotton's question. What part of the system since 1949 is now broke that we need to correct?
The Department of Labor has been enforcing it all along, but there's been a failure for employers to notify many employees of this right, that they have the right to return transportation if they've been brought to our state, so they wouldn't be stranded here after their job ends. And that's been worked on. Some of the industries do a very good job of it. Others aren't even aware of it. Secondly, is the whole concept that we want to try to maximize the potential to remove people from our social service system if they want to return home, and to give them as many options as possible not to be stranded in Alaska if they've come up here from another place to work.
Do we have some numbers, or is this a problem now that it wasn't? I didn't know it existed as a problem, I guess. I mean, are people, hundreds of people getting stuck in Dutch Harbor or something and not being able to get home, or cannery workers being abandoned in the Aleutian chain or something, or what's happening?
There was a problem in the past. I remember that, and I see Mr. Lauber's here, but I don't want to pick on Dutch Harbor, but there was a situation of people getting hired to go out to fish and promised, or at least led to believe, that they were going to get so many hours a week or whatever, and they get there and discover they have to buy rain gear and they have to buy boots and they have to pay some room and board, and then they were only working 1 hour a week and discovered that they were going backwards and not forwards, and pretty soon they didn't even have enough money for an airplane ticket back. And I think I recall us doing something a few years ago saying you got to pay their, I guess it is, maybe if you paid your way their way out there, you got to pay their way back. Maybe that's what the answer was. But
I guess that's the part that has me concerned, is that unless there is a contractual obligation up front, what's to prevent you as an employer in Ketchikan from having a guy walk in off the street from someplace in Australia who says, got a green card, and says, gee, I'd really like to go to work here, and you say, fine, we'll put you on slime and fish, and 3 weeks later, you lay him off because the rush is over with, and he turns to the Department of Labor because you've now notified him that you have to pay his way home, and now your seafood plant is buying him a one-way ticket back to New Zealand or something. I can easily see that occur. I guess this is a proposal to make certain that we make it attractive for and protect every out-of-state worker that comes up here to take a job.
Representative Donnelly, and then
that's what he's trying to do.
That's what I was. It shocked me that Mr. Donnelly would be bringing this kind of language.
Representative Taylor, the Department of Labor hasn't interpreted it that way in the past, and this proposal wouldn't require that, because now that, especially with the proposed amendments before you that I've suggested, clarifies that it's the place where the point of fire takes place, where the individual is cited, so that if a person walks into your office as an employer, you hired them there at your office and not in Australia or wherever they originally came from before they made it to Ketchikan.
Just as a follow-up, Mr. Chairman, how then would any employer ever be obligated then to say transportation away? Point, all you have to do is say, hey, you weren't hired until you walked through the door, kid.
Representative Donnelly?
That's very similar to the chair's question earlier, which I deferred to the Department of Labor because they've been dealing with that problem over the years with this statute, and this particular legislation makes no change in that current status.
Representative Barnes, if you can still remember your question.
I think I remember part of it. Representative Donnelly, suppose two persons made a contract that says, in fact, this company did not have to pay their way back to the point of origin. Does the contract then become null and void under this legislation?
There's two answers to that. First of all, it's my impression from the Department of Labor that they're currently administrating it so that people can't agree to do that. Now, I need to defer to them about this, but that they're interpreting is it, or under their proposed amendments, it tightens that up so that agreement could only be made at the end of the contract. And secondly, under my proposed legislation, clearly that would be prohibited, especially with the Department of Labor amendment. And the reason for that is, the policy reason, is because it's easy to exert undue influence over a person at that early point in the employment relationship, and it should be more adequately dealt with at the end of the relationship than the beginning.
Representative Barnes.
Mr. Chairman, I just really have a problem with that. My problem being that when you enter into a job contract, that's in the beginning, not after the fact. I mean, after the fact, good God, nobody's going to say, no, I don't want to have you pay my way home. They're going to say, in fact, there's no way they'd sign a contract. Would you agree?
To the chair. Certainly, I don't think, if I was an individual who wanted to go back to my point of fire, I wouldn't waive my right to do so at the end of the contract. I may be unduly influenced at the beginning of the contract and waive my right to do so without consideration of what my financial condition will be at the end of the contract, thus burdening the state of Alaska with me as a social service plan.
Representative Barnes.
But there's just something very wrong with that, because a person that has reached the age of majority should be able to make the determination as to whether, in fact, they can enter into a contract and at the beginning of employment rather than waiting to the end, because nobody's going to do that. If my colleague from Wrangell wanted to give me a job and he'd say, these are the conditions of employment and here's a contract, if I wanted that job being old enough to make those determinations, I should be able to sign that contract without the laws of the state of Alaska.
A similar example would be, should an individual be able to waive their right to workman's compensation? Should an individual be able to waive their right to unemployment insurance? The states made those decisions that those are important protections in the workplace, just as this legislation has established this as an important protection in the workplace, or as the existing law already does, and this merely strengthens it.
It's basically interpreted not to be an individual's right. It's just like overtime. You can't waive your right to be paid overtime either. It's a societal right. That's the way the statutes are written. So it's a policy call. Any other questions, Representative Donnelly? Dave, you're more than welcome to pull up a chair here and join us. Department of Labor, have someone here to clarify your present policy?
Yes, sir.
Join us on the end of the table. Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm Tom Stewart, represent the Department of Labor. I am the Director of Labor Standards and Safety. The Department supports the committee substitute House Bill 43. We feel that it addresses several issues that have come up in the past in our enforcement of that return transportation. And we feel that it is going to prevent exploitation of workers. It will not have a fiscal impact on our department. Our experience in the past to address some of the questions that just came up, we have had the majority of our complaints and our case files are from employees that were recruited in the lower 48, mainly in the Seattle, Oregon area, not Northern California. At the time of hire, the point of contact of hire, these people are desirous to go to work to the point that they will almost agree to anything. We hope that within these amendments to tighten it up so that they are notified of their rights that they're going to waive. Also, in reference to some questions, the past 2 years, 1985 and 1986, the department has averaged approximately 80 cases of stranded employees. A large percentage of them are fishery related, cannery, fish boat operators, crews. 15 to 20 of the 80 calls are strictly telephone calls or written explanation solved. The employer is notified that he must return the person to his point of hire. 50 to 60 of those calls are contested cases where we actually go into legal procedures on it to clarify the case, build the parameters of the location hired point and the promises made to that employee before he came to Alaska. Out of those 50 to 60, we actually have monies recovered from about 43 to 47% of them. Some of those cases are over the $5,000 limit that the policy set by the department. We don't handle them, they go to civil court. So this is a major problem with hiring employees from outside the state. It is also a problem with hiring employees in the state. Your Dutch Harbor, your Wrangell, for instance. If a person is hired in Ketchikan and shipped out to an island or another area to work, most of the time, the people are out there without a bona fide income in their hand that they can spend. They have a problem getting back to their Ketchikan base or their area that they were actually hired at. This will address that problem.
Any questions, Mr. Stewart? Representative Taylor?
Mr. Stewart, how long have you been with the department?
Representative Taylor, to the chair. I've been with the department about 3 weeks.
The numbers you were talking about were the numbers that you researched back through, and they were about 80 a year.
Right? Yes, sir.
Okay. You said other than about 15 of them, those are all fishery related?
No, sir. 15 to 20 of them, money solved cases were fishery related that could be handled over the phone or with just a letter of clarification to the employer. The balance of that 50 to 60 that we had in each year actually go to litigation, about 50-50 on construction and fishing.
This has been historic. I mean, far back as you know, it's run about 80 a year. It's an increasing thing or a decreasing thing?
Representative Taylor, through the chair, prior to the construction boom for the gas, for the pipeline and for Puto Bay, it was mainly fishery and construction. Due to the large influx of people brought in to do the pipeline and Puto Bay work, then construction stopped shadowing the percentage on fishery. Over the past 10 or 12 years, it's been an increasing percentage. But the last 2 years has averaged about 80 cases. So that it's an average for the last, last 6-8 years, according to information I have. Some years quite a bit higher, quite a bit lower. The last 2 years.
Representative Grunberg?
Sir, I gather that this statute that all the statutes relate to this are found in this single article, Article 5, Transportation of Employees. These are all the statutes on the subject in this
President,
one article.
President Reamer, to the chair, yes, sir, I believe so.
Is there any requirement that the employee be informed of his right to return transportation? Does the employer have to tell them that they have this right? Maybe I see the representative.
Chair. Mr. Chairman?
Representative Donnelly.
Under existing law, there is no requirement that the employer notify the employee. Under the proposed legislation, it adds that requirement.
I'm sorry if I asked this question.
Thank you.
Mr.
Chairman? Representative Taylor.
Yeah. Mr. Stewart, is it true the department's present position on the statute of limitations thing was that if I hired on 10 years ago with ABC Company, and now they're going out of business, or somehow I'm being terminated, now I'm going to tell ABC Company they got to fly me back to Albuquerque?
Representative Taylor, to the chair. No, sir. Our policy has been to use the two-year time frame. That's been a within reason.
But I thought there was nothing.
It's just a policy. At this point in time, there's nothing in the statute that covers it. We have used that at that point due to the fact that if a person employed a longer length of time than that, the liability is going to be higher enough that it falls outside of our parameters. We don't
have $5,000 to buy a ticket around the world.
Yes, sir. Through the chair, generally speaking, someone who has been employed that length of time would have a moving cost also that would take it outside the $5,000 plane, taking it and moving.
The backup information from the Department of Administration shows that the average move of a state employee is $12,000 if you're moving household goods and whatever, so we're talking more than just plane tickets here.
Well, I guess that's what I'm getting at. If someone calls you up, John, from Seattle, you hire them for your plant in Ketchikan, when they arrive and go to work, you tell them, well, now I have to pay for the cost of moving you and your family and all your household goods up to Ketchikan, and if you quit, I have to turn around and pay the same price to keep you back. Huh?
We hire through the employment office in Ketchikan.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you.
We have a big sign in the plant that says go downtown and sign up and we'll hire you through there. So we only pay the transportation from downtown to the plant. It's about 6 blocks.
Yeah.
Tell them to walk.
Good idea.
I want to get a clarification on an issue. Say somebody wants to just, you know, you got a fish camp, you're somewhere, but you say, we are hiring out of Anchorage. Anchorage is our hiring point. And we will pay transportation from Anchorage to the construction camp, whatever, and back. And people call up, right? I mean, maybe they're out of state, maybe they're in state, wherever. Maybe they're in Ketchikan, I don't care, pick a spot. And they say, I want to go to work. And you say, send me a resume, and you get it, and you talk about it on the phone. They say, okay, well, you know, looks like you got a job. Come on into Anchorage, we'll get you set up. What's, under this bill that we have in front of us, what's the scenario?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the way I understand the scenario on that would be that if a person is contacted in Seattle, Louisiana, Oklahoma, to come to work there, and the agreement is made over the phone to come to work, that person would require the transportation back to his...
Regardless of who made the contact, whether the prospective employee contacted the employer,
yes,
and asked about the conditions, and the employer says, hey, we're hiring out of Anchorage?
Yes, sir.
And so it doesn't matter what I'm trying to get is the employer has an ad out or has a recruiting officer out and trying to find people and solicits a person outside of state. That's the employer going out. And I'm trying to distinguish that. What about the employee that makes a phone call? I think everybody, if I had my buddies in Ketchikan and that's a deal, they'd all probably run down to Santa Barbara and start calling from Santa Barbara so they could get a plane ticket to California when the deal's over.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that... under that example, if the person from Santa Barbara calls Ketchikan looking for a job, and you say, we're hiring here, we've come here to be interviewed for a possibility of a project, then at that point in time, Ketchikan would be his point of hire. If you interview the man over the phone and come to an agreement for a guaranteed job when he gets here, then Santa Barbara is his point of hire.
Okay, then I guess that gets us to page 2, lines 4 and 5 of this, the wording here. I don't know if this is new or old, but it's the person cited, I guess. I don't know why outside the state there's there, but when the employer agreed to employ, seems to me the critical language. If you're a tricky employer, you're...
And recited. Because they could just be cited there temporarily. I think it should be recited.
Okay, but I want to get to the end of that sentence. When the employer agreed to employ, the good, sneaky employer that knows about this statute, you know, couches his languages and uses a follow-up letter to get it in writing that, you know, if you show up here, you know, we'll think about it, right? And the casual guy out there says, yeah, it looks pretty good. You know, why don't you come on up? What's the employer agreed to employ? That's the commitment in whose mind that they have a job? The employer's mind or the employee's mind?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Whose mental state does the job have to exist in? The employer's mind or the employee's mind?
I believe it would be a combined agreement between two people, the employer and the employee. They both agree that there's a project involved, a guaranteed place of employment when the person arrives at the job site. It's a mutual consent. It's a mutual agreement.
Representative Ulmer?
It might be possible to clarify the language so that it would read, when the employer offered to employ.
That's a little more clarifying than this, yeah.
So a specific job offer would be the point in time at which the obligation would attach.
Well, I guess I'm trying to pursue Representative Barnes's point there, is that you can't even seem to make an agreement in writing here to decide where the point of employment is. If I follow the prior discussion here, that if the employee believes in his mind that he had a job guaranteed to him, you can't even clarify that in writing if they want to both sit down and write an agreement and say, no, I agree to be hired in Ketchikan, not in Santa Barbara, that they can't do that, if I understand the testimony correct. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I believe that's what I understand.
Representative Gruenberg and Representative Taylor?
Yeah, I think that focus on the word offer versus agreement, if I can go back to Representative Ulmer's statement. This doesn't only apply to cannery workers, but it could apply to a high-powered executive, $100,000 executive, chief executive officer, CEO for a large corporation. Let's say a corporation goes out and gets a headhunter, and it takes a certain amount of time between the time that there is a first offer to employ, and then they negotiate all the benefits and everything else, and that person, the potential employee, could have been moving around significantly between those two periods of time. And I would rather see it be at the time of the agreement, because otherwise they are stuck forevermore wherever the person happened to be at the time the first offer was made, even if that offer was never accepted and there was a considerable period of time that elapsed. You should focus on the time the actual agreement was made, it seems to me.
Representative Taylor and then Navarre.
Yeah, I've been trying to get the basis for why we need this thing, and it seems to me that probably, or maybe one of the unwritten things that's going on around here, unspoken part of this scenario, is that we're trying to place a burden upon the employer. For any employer that might even think about bringing in somebody from outside the state, we're going to hammer them with this thing. I wouldn't want to suggest that may be what the department's doing, but it kind of smells that way. So as a consequence, maybe what we should do on this legislation, so as to really make that effective, is that any employee that comes into this state and applies for residency for purposes of the 30-day shot, you know, signing up to vote so they can sneak around our local hire law, or applies for residency so they can get our Christmas bonus, the permanent fund, any employee who does that, as soon as he's done it, we ought to notify him that he just lost his right to have his employer ship him back home. Because once he's declared he's going to live here, he shouldn't be able to hang around for a couple years and then all of a sudden kick the employer in the head by saying, oh, I'm quitting now, and I'm going back to, with my little pointy-toed shoes, back to Albuquerque. See? I think that would have a lot, do what you're trying to accomplish here a lot better, see? Keep those down southers out of here.
Representative Barr?
There's some way we can just ship them to Siberia?
Well, those guys have been trying to get over there. They keep bringing them back.
I was just wondering how much it is different.
Point of hire, right?
Different from current law. See,
That was my next
that
question
we're
here. Is
about current law, it's my understanding.
So current law only makes you pay the return trip if you paid for just pick it up. Now you're saying if he got up on his own, as long as you agree to hire or whatever that statement is.
And you have to notify them of their right. I think that's a very, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a real important provision.
But it's only if the agreement was made while they were outside. Somebody who comes up, isn't that true? I mean, if someone comes up to Alaska and happens to apply for a job and gets hired, and he happens to be from New Mexico, you don't have to pay their way back.
Well, not if you're the second one.
If you made a deal with them. I doubt if there's that many problems anyway, where if someone makes a deal with them on the phone, this can be.
Well, I'll give you the example that I'm somewhat familiar with is the resort business. There's a lot of resorts all over the state that say their point of hire, they pay transportation to and from the nearest Alaskan city, the largest city around, whether it's Sitka, Juneau, Ketchikan, Anchorage, Fairbanks, to fly their employees out and back, and regardless of whether residents or non-residents. But what this is going to do is give all the non-residents an airplane ticket all the way back to where they came from, wherever that is.
Not if you have a smart employer.
No, it doesn't matter because you can't contract the right away, if I understand this.
Which is the point of hire?
Well, that's it gets down to this. You go away from the test in the existing statute, if I understand it right, is did you pay their way out? If you did, you got to pay their way back. That's a very factual, you know, easy test. This one here, the test now is on page 2, line 5, when the employer agreed to employ. That's the test now. And wherever the person was at the time that agreement was made, whether it's verbal or in writing, now becomes the return point. And Tom, correct me if I'm wrong. Is that the correct scenario? I don't want to have the wrong assumption on the table.
Mr. Chairman, basically, yes. The question at this point, the way I understand it, is that where do you send them to done with? The idea of this program here is that if a person who is not a resident state is in the state looking for a job, walks into your office in Ketchikan and interviews for a project, and you send him out on another island somewhere, then you owe him transportation back to the point of hire that you've been in your office in Ketchikan. If someone calls you from some other state, out from someplace outside the state, and you agree to make him a sling operator or a steeplejack, come on to work, be here in 20 days or 10 days, then you owe him back to where he called from, where his point of abode was. Where that's his point of hire, the point where you guys agreed to make the decision that yes, I want you to work, come work for me now. But if the man is in the state looking for a job, and you hire him in Ketchikan, but you're going to send him to Dutch Harbor or send him out here someplace, then if you transport him out from your point of hire or your office at that point, then you owe him to turn back at that point.
Representative Donnelly?
Mr. Chairman, the existing law also references point of hire. Says the person shall provide the person with return transportation to the place of hire from which transportation was furnished or fined.
Right.
So it also uses a similar.
But it couples it up with the ticket, transportation ticket.
That is correct.
So the issue is that if you say your point of hire is, we're going to provide airplane transportation from Anchorage to Dutch Harbor, the existing statute says they got to fly them back to Anchorage. They don't have to fly them back to Albuquerque. Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, this is a question for Representative Donnelly, if I may. I think that the requirement in subsection C that they notify the employee of their right is very important, because this right is not the kind of thing that the person would normally intuitively know that they have. And would you support an amendment there that would require that the notification be in writing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have no problem with that.
But only the Department of Labor.
No, sir.
And you would like that?
Yes, sir.
In writing, by posting the notice in the, I mean, do you have to give each individual employee an individual letter, or can you post it in the workplace?
I would say posting is fine.
Then they're not gonna know till they get there.
Yeah, but you're talking about return trip anyway.
Put it right alongside the OSHA.
Sure.
Well, I thought you could put it in it.
Sure, put it right there. I don't care. As long as it's somewhere. And then if they don't read it, El Topo.
But by the way, we're telling how many people got hurt on the job that year.
Only on the return trip, right?
Is there any other questions of Mr. Stewart? Is there anybody else who wants to testify on this bill? Mr. Lauber? Since we've been picking on the fishing industry, I guess, or using the fishing industry as an example of how this legislation may be implemented.
Chairman, I'm absolutely shocked. It's been the first time anything of that nature has ever happened. Mr. Chairman, my name is Rick Lauber. I represent Pacific Seafood Processors Association. If you'll bear with me, I don't happen to have the proposed amendments, but I think I understand at least those that are considered significant.
This isn't all.
The seafood industry in practice has contracts with employees that they provide transportation for, to return them to their point of hire at the completion of the season, the completion of the contract. And we believe that employers should live up to those contracts, and we would encourage the employees to do the same. It creates problems for employers in the seafood industry if an employee in a remote location should, at a whim, decide that they want to leave. It's difficult to find replacements. I'm not making any distinction now between residents and non-resident employees. As far as we're concerned, they should be treated the same. The only difference would be that, at least in some cases, the transportation costs would be higher if transporting workers from outside. We would hope that every employee would live across the street from the plant and go home for lunch, but that isn't the way things work. We have to hire employees from locations other than the location of a plant, particularly those in remote areas. We objected to the original legislation, which actually, as far as I could tell, made only two significant changes in the existing law, and that would be that the notification, the requirement for notification, and the other one would be that the employee be returned to the place of residency of the employee. I understand that that may have been altered in some way, but let me reinforce my opposition to that. The seafood industry, starting a project a number of years ago, has, for instance, increased their hire using the Department of Labor from about 7 years ago, when I understand the using Department of Labor statistics, we employed about 200 people using the Department of Labor employment offices. In 1985, the last figures that I had, the Commissioner of Labor testified that we hired approximately 9,000 workers using Department of Labor offices that year. But a rather interesting phenomenon, to us at least, when we were found out that we had a great number of non-residents, that the Department of Labor offices, of employment offices, are largely funded through the federal government, which prohibits them discriminating between residents and non-residents when they send employees or prospective employees to us. So therefore, many of the people that are sent to us, and others I'm sure, particularly in the summertime, are are non-residents. Under this bill, it has nothing to do with the point of hire. A small seafood plant operating in Ketchikan could hire from the downtown office of the Department of Labor and walk their 6 blocks only to be returned to Toledo, Ohio at the end of the, because that would be their residency. It was not their point of hire under this bill. You can imagine that that would create quite a problem for anyone, because at one point we wouldn't necessarily know where their residency was until it was disclosed at a later time. If the bill is altered, I understand, to return the employee to the point of hire, that still creates a problem. And that is that if the employee is not required to complete their contract, now I'm not now talking about a contract where there's an agreement to either return people or not return people, but the contract to work the season in a plant in Bristol Bay, who it was disclosed at later time, merely obtained employment to be shipped out to have a weekend visit with a friend. And at the conclusion of the weekend, demand that they be returned to their point of hire, which under the existing law, and those cases have been contested. Now, the figures used by the Department of Labor today would indicate that there were approximately an average of 80 claims made for all industries in the state, even assuming that a majority of those cases are fisheries related. It would not indicate that the practice of not paying return transportation is widespread. I particularly want to call your attention to the figures that Mr. Stewart used. In the vast majority of the 80 cases, 50, 60 of them, were contested cases. That means there was a disagreement, presumably, between the employer and the employee. Of those contested cases, if I understood them correctly, somewhat less than 50% of those were resolved in favor of the employee. So of 80 cases, presumably half or a little over half are resolved in the employee's favor under the existing law. It's understandable that, and we have cases where employees have not completed their contract and made a request from the Department of Labor for return transportation. Under the existing law, it's up to the Department of Labor to determine whether there was just cause for the termination. If there was, then the employer is not responsible. If there was not, the employer is responsible. I think that that is a reasonable method, and to my knowledge, we have no complaint with the system that we're presently operating in. But I want to reiterate the untenable position the legislature could put us in if you would require that a person be required to pay return transportation at any time the employee decides to terminate and return. Now, as far as our operations, and I understand that I don't necessarily speak for a majority in numbers of our fish processing plants, although I think members of my association by far represent the employers of the majority of the people. Our contracts, our union contracts, some 17 of them, all contain language requiring us to pay return transportation at the conclusion of the contract, regardless of whether the person is resident or non-resident. The original bill, the only distinction, the only changes made, involved non-residents. As far as I could determine, really made no change in the existing law. It would be no different for residents. But the notification would only be made to non-residents. In other words, an employer would not be required to inform a resident Alaskan of the fact that they are entitled to return transportation. And under the original draft and the LNC committee substitute, the only people that would be required to are entitled to return transportation are non-residents. I understand that that has been corrected. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any questions, Mr. Lauber? Representative Taylor?
Can I take it in general that your people are opposed to this bill?
In the form in which it is, we're not opposed to the existing law, and as I said, we think that people ought to live up to their contracts. We agree to pay return transportation to those employees that complete their contract or work out the season. We think that that should be done. Likewise, we do not want to encourage people to take a job, work for a few days or a few weeks, at their whim decide to quit, and then we would be forced to pay them return transportation, either to their residency or to their point of hire. But we do think that we should live up to our contract where we would pay them return transportation.
Representative Cotton and then Donnelly.
So the way it works now, the department determines if the employee, if there's a dispute, the department just decides. Like if I just don't like Slime and John's fish anymore, just decide to quit, and you don't want to pay my way back, then the department decides whether or not you will.
That's right.
What kind of history is that, have we seen there? I mean, I can see the one example you gave where the person wanted to visit somebody for a couple of days and you fly them to Cold Bay and it gets pretty expensive, but they're in the middle of the season, they just don't like it, or their grandmother dies, or...
Wasn't the example about 50%? About out of the 80 cases, 50% went one way and 50 the other way?
Yes, I think that... I remember someone said 43% were resolved in favor of the employee, and then there were 15 or 20 cases that resulted in paying over a phone call. The answer to your question is that the Department of Labor has not allowed those types of claims, in my understanding. It had to be what they considered a legitimate, it was a legitimate reason for terminating the employee, and you did not have to pay return transportation. They were fighting, they were drunk, or...
What about the notice? What do you have to say about the notice provision? Did you have a problem with that?
Well, the only thing I said was that under the bill that I saw, the two versions, it only applies to non-residents. And if you're going to have notice given that a person is entitled to return transportation, why is it just non-residents that are notified? Why can't it be everyone that's notified that they're entitled to return transportation?
But you don't speak in opposition to the notice requirement generally?
Well, it's not a problem for me because the vast majority of our members, I don't know if it would be constructive notice or not, but they're represented by unions, and it's in their union contracts, and they're well aware of it. We generally don't have a problem. I'm not going to say that there aren't cases where people would be let off of small holder processors or so forth. I would mention a situation that this law will not correct, or any other law will correct. It will not solve the problem of a business, regardless of what type of a business. It goes bankrupt. And there are a number of those cases where people all the way from, I think every carnival or circus that ever came to the state has left stranded everything from orangutans to tent pounders, and we're not going to solve that problem. And we do have cases where people just go out of business and they do not pay their employees, and of course legislation will solve that.
Hey, clarify, Rick, on your contract, you're saying on the contract you pay the way out, and completion of contract is usually stay in the season or until the employer shuts the plant down, then they get their way paid back.
That's correct.
But if they leave at any point in between that on their own accord, they're paying their own airfare.
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Lauber, that last question you raised struck a note with me. When people either go out of... there are two reasons I can see at least why the return trip would not be paid. Either the person doesn't have any assets or refuses to pay, or the person goes bankrupt. If there's a bankruptcy situation, my recollection is that that there's a first priority. It's a, your preferred creditor if there's a lien. I mean, I'm sorry, if there's wages owed to the employee. And I'm not certain if there's other priorities if something is considered wages.
You got to pay the fisherman.
Well, I understand that. But my question is, under present law, and I'd ask you or Mr. Donnelly or the people from the Department of Labor, if you know whether the return trip, the costs of the return trip, are considered wages within the meaning of preferred creditors for bankruptcy, for example. Because if a company goes bankrupt, let's say a fishing company in the Aleutians goes bankrupt, there are going to be a lot of people who are stranded there. And my concern is that at least we ought to get them their way paid back if there's a danger of bankruptcy. And I think this should be considered as one aspect of wages. Can anybody here tell me whether it is under present law?
I don't know.
I don't think it is.
Well, I would like maybe, if we're going to be doing a little research on some of these other points that are raised here today, staff or somebody to take a look at that, because it seems to me very definitely they should be considered part, so we don't have a company going bankrupt, can't pay all of its bills. At the very least, we ought to pay the workers way back from the Aleutian chamber.
Yeah, we have to post bonds so that they can pay the fishermen. They have to post up cash bonds for to be able to pay those bills, so we might put it into that.
Representative Donnelly?
Mr. Chairman, the proposed legislation before you, the Labor and Commerce substitute, other than very, very minor shifting of a word, makes no changes in the existing law regarding the Department of Labor making those types of determinations. So I don't really understand Mr. Lauber's concern, because the bill before us doesn't make any change in the matter that's being discussed.
Well, I note on page 1, line 24, you have a proposed amendment to delete the words residing outside the state. So that takes care of the notice issue everybody's talked about, and everybody has to get notice.
Mr. Chairman, the specific portion that deals with the role of the Department of Labor is paragraph 1 in the existing law that's re-enumerated or restated in paragraph 2, line 17 of the Labor and Commerce draft that's before you. And the wording is identical, other than moving one word to the end of the sentence and putting it in before the sentence, which is something the drafter, that was part of the drafting of 1949, has changed. So the law is identical as it's before you, other than moving the word termination to the end of the sentence rather than inserting it in there. It's just a drafting. So there would be no change in the Department of Labor's role.
I understand that. Mr. Lauber?
On the L&C version on page 2, line 4, section 2, it states the person residing outside the state when the employer agreed to employ the person for work inside the state. That is new language as far as I'm concerned, and that's what I was referring to. Mr. Donnelly.
Okay. If I could, then paragraph 1, page 1, line 29, and going over to page 2, line 3, that's also existing language.
It's an existing concept.
Mr. Chairman, that's the new language. The language I'm referring to is the language that is the Department of Labor's role. That comes from the statute, paragraph 1, in the statute as it's today in Alaska law, which is re-enumerated in paragraph 2 of the Labor and Commerce version, and in the draft that's before you is also in paragraph 2, which makes no change.
But yeah. Your question is yes, that's an existing law. That's existing A, first section in the existing law.
It's in section
first
A of the existing law. It's now section D, 1, and Section 2 is new language as far as I can determine.
That's correct. Section 2, line 29, the carried in, so that's the new language. So, well, the concern here is it doesn't have any impact on the issue of employees voluntarily quitting outside the term of their contract. That portion of the law is not changed by the bill that's before them.
I'm not sure of that myself. Well, Representative Cotton.
Well, what happens in your industry? You probably already said this. It sounds like I'm asking some questions that have already been answered, but give us an example of where the cannery workers are usually hired. Where does that usually take place? Does that usually take place in Seattle? Like,
no.
You send a does a cannery send a recruiter down to Seattle, and then they file in, fill out the forms, and they're sent up to Alaska at that point?
No, there's relatively few. In fact, the cannery workers union in Seattle only has about 1,500 members. They may be residents of a number of places. The single largest source of employment for fish processing plants is the State Department of Labor.
But do companies routinely send recruiters down, or do go to Seattle to hire people?
No. We send recruiters to the University of Alaska at Fairbanks and Anchorage, and we use the local offices of the Department of Labor for recruiting of new employees. Our contracts then read that if you have worked for a company or plant previously, you have the first right of hire. And then the next order, the contracts usually read that if you have worked in the industry, you have the first right of hire. Now, those employees would not then probably go through the Department of Labor. They would make direct application to the employer and be rehired.
Well, that's what I mean. Like the canneries I've been around, haven't been too many of them, but for instance out in Sandpoint, you'd go over to the cannery workers barracks and none of them were from Alaska. And it didn't really, you know, it wasn't like I was going to complain about it because I didn't know anybody in Alaska wanted that job, but I assumed that somebody had gone someplace else to hire everybody. They'd all been hired at a point outside the state, and then either their transportation was or wasn't paid into the state. I didn't really understand at the time. But.
Well, I don't know that individual location, but as I say, one of the situations that we have found is in an effort to increase our local hire, and also it's good business for us because transportation is a very high cost of doing business. Transporting workers is a very expensive method of doing business. So we have increased our recruiting in the state largely using the Department of Labor offices and using figures given by the then Commissioner of Labor in the last year that we had figures for. We had hired first-time employees, approximately 9,000 of them, through the Department of Labor. Now, most of those employees that the Department of Labor of the state of Alaska sent to us were non-residents to the state of Alaska. Now, presumably, they had gotten up here some way on their own. I don't know. I don't think they're paying them their way up here. But then they were sent out from that location. You can see why it would give us heartburn then if we recruited someone from Ketchikan and sent them to Metlakatla. If we would then have to pay their return transportation to their residency, which might be Salt Lake City.
Right. What about the people that are hired in Seattle? I mean, there's, for instance, ABC Corporation is home based in Seattle. Do those people typically get their way paid to to Alaska?
Yes, their way is paid and their return transportation.
So, just for my own information, this will be the last question I'll ask on this subject: is if you had 9,000 that were furnished through the Department of Labor or other in-state sources, how many people were hired as a result of, for whatever reason, but you allowed that if they'd worked here before, they had preference, or if they'd worked in the industry, they had a preference. How many people are you talking about there?
Well, there's figures vary, but I think we must be talking somewhere between 35 and 40,000 people.
35 to 40,000.
Whether they're different people or whether they're just different hires, and some of those figures are, it might be the same person is hired a number of times during the year, but in the number of hires, it's substantial.
But those cases, I mean, that doesn't shouldn't affect you either, because you're already paying their way to Alaska, right? And so it isn't like this is something new on those people. If they, those people, those 35 or 40,000, were paying their own way north, and this bill made you pay their way back home, I could see how it would affect you. But since you're paying their way north anyway, and being required to pay their way back, it shouldn't really be an impact in that regard, then.
No, and I hope I didn't imply that it
is. Yeah, no, I'm just trying to understand, making sure I understand.
The thing that I think that if we hire someone and we agree to pay, which we do, their transportation up here, and we agree to pay their return transportation at the conclusion of the season, that we should do that. What I am saying, a problem would be created if we were required to give notice to an employee at any time that they desired to quit, we must pay their return transportation to their point of hire, within or without the state, but that would be a hardship.
Yeah, I understand that.
A person would just take advantage of it. It wouldn't take people very long to figure out that they could go home anytime they wanted to and be paid for it. Not only would it work a hardship on us in the sense that, that we would pay the return transportation, we're going to do that anyway at the end of the season. But the problem is, at the height of the season, we have fish coming out the, and 30-some people walk off. That's a line. That means we have to put fishermen on limits. It means that we cannot handle the runs and so forth.
I understand
we
that.
We need to keep the people on the site. And it's not, there's a remote location. We just can't go down town and say, send us 30 more people. There aren't 30 people to send us. And quite frankly, one of the incentives, and a major incentive for people staying on that job, is the fact that they will get return transportation if they complete the job. Otherwise, we usually provide them the transportation, but their ticket is then deducted out of their final check. And as I say, it's a pretty good incentive to stay on the job for another week or 10 days or whatever it might be.
Representative Ulmer?
Mr. Lauber, I don't see the language in this committee substitute which does what you have just said. In other words, the way I read it, under A in Section 1, the law with regard to termination is not being changed. Isn't that correct?
Yes, but under, on page 2, line 4.
But that's just a part of the same section. In other words, that's amending 2310.380, which is the same section 2310.380 on the first page of this bill. It talks about the conditions under which termination is permitted. And it talks about, you know, employment terminated within 1 year of the person's first day of employment, et cetera, et cetera. It's not when any, it's not any time they want to go. Is it?
Mm-hmm.
It appears to me it's not any time they want to go. It is the time, in terms of when they go, is determined by Section A on the first page.
Well,
Mr. Donnelly is agreeing with me, but Mr. Lauber isn't, so we still have a difference of opinion.
I think
here.
Then what is the purpose of Section 2 on page 2?
To cover the condition when the employer has not agreed in advance to pay the way back. It doesn't say any time you want to go. It simply says, even for those employees who did not get from their employer beforehand an agreement to go back at the employer's expense, they get to go back at the employer's expense. Not any time they want to, but only when Section A on the first page applies. The employment terminated with 1 year after the first day of employment, the department determines termination was for a good and sufficient cause, or the person after the termination of employment.
Yes, it's 1, 2, and 3 is my excuse me.
Mm-hmm. It's okay. I'm just saying it's all those. The question is, do the same terms of termination apply? As I read this bill, they do. The only difference is that it applies to a larger category of people, that is, employees of employers who did not agree at the beginning to pay their way back. So it doesn't change. I don't think it means that somebody out in Dutch Harbor can choose to go home anytime they choose and get their way paid.
Yeah, it would. If the person, let's say the employee, was a person who resided outside the state when the employer agreed to employ that person. And I think that the vast majority of people would fall into that category. So it's really broadening the net considerably.
But the question is, when is it terminated? It's true it applies to more people. The question is, what is the trigger? It's still termination, and termination is on the first page. And it may or may not be too tight or too loose, but it's the same as it is now, if I understand it correctly. That isn't being changed.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Donnelly.
Representative Oldburn is exactly right. The legislation makes no change in the trigger whatsoever. It merely recites what's already an existing statute, and that trigger is in a whole separate section than the paragraph that Mr. Lobbers expressed concerns about. And Representative Ulmer's analysis is exactly accurate.
Representative DeVar.
I'm not an attorney.
That's good. The last person that sat there last year wasn't an attorney either.
But seems to me like this could be triggered under D. It doesn't have to have A as a qualifier for the trigger. Mm-hmm. So that it could trigger under A, could trigger under B if there is a B, or it could trigger under this D.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I just ask a question? Does anybody else in the audience want to testify in this bill? So we make sure we get all the testimony in today. That's all. Okay, there is none. I'd like to, I think we have a bunch of amendments here, and a bunch of us need to take time to think about it. I'm going to hold the bill over till Friday. And I'd like to get some, those people who have these concerns can read about it. And I'd like to get some testimony on the next bill. It's also Representative Donnelly's bill. And I'll work with staff on this issue, and we'll work with the sponsor on some language and see if we can clarify it.
I think an and might take care of it.
Good.
An and between C and D.
Okay. Representative Donnelly, you want to start out on House Bill 28 so we can get it started here? It's an act relating to penalties, municipal penalties for prostitution. Another simple one-paragraph bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The request of our assembly representatives in Anchorage, Representative Grunberg and myself, introduced this legislation. It's strictly a local option law. It allows municipalities, if they so wish, and if they want to bear the burden of the cost, to adopt mandatory minimum sentencing for the crimes of prostitution. I believe Representative Grunberg's to back up a second, in Community Regional Affairs, the committee substitute addresses a problem that's in state statute in that the state has no so-called John law, Mr. Chairman. So that although
you're referring to anybody in particular?
Yeah.
That's somebody whose name's John.
Mr. Chairman. So that municipalities do. Several municipalities do, and the city of Anchorage, municipality of Anchorage, is one that does. So that we had to change the legislation slightly to allow municipalities to incorporate that crime also as to apply mandatory minimums to that. I understand that Representative Grunberg has a proposal to expand that to include those misdemeanor crimes those crimes of pimping that are misdemeanors under the existing statute. The reason it wasn't included in the legislation in the first place was because there is a classification of pimping that is a Class C felony, and thus the sponsor, I didn't feel it was necessary to include it in this legislation, but additional research has indicated that there are some charges that come in as misdemeanors, and the sponsor would be receptive to accepting that amendment to include those within the mandatory minimum jurisdiction of municipalities also. But the key thing here is it's strictly a local option. If a municipality chooses to do it, it should pay the cost for doing it, for the incarceration and the prosecution. It shouldn't, and it merely allows them the flexibility of dealing with the problem. Other communities along the West Coast have enacted such laws, and that is, according to testimony we've had from the police at the community council level, one of the main reasons that we've had the influx of prostitution problem in Anchorage is basically they ran them out of Seattle and Los Angeles, and then they moved to easier grounds.
They probably still have some left down there. This is part of the Bernard in Motion legislation, I take it. So, I guess my only question is...
my tongue, let the record show my tongue.
Yes. Looking through the fiscal notes, I see a court fiscal note here of about $15,000. And I want to request a Department of Corrections fiscal note. The testimony we had in Corrections Oversight was that the municipality is only paying $35 a day to house prisoners in the 6th and C jail, and it costs the Department of Corrections considerably more than that to provide the service. And we asked Corrections why they didn't charge more. We never really got an answer back, but...
Maybe substitute as 2 zeros.
Yes, you may substitute as 2 zero fiscal notes now?
This is not to be known as a revenue enhancer.
No, but I don't want to have it as a revenue decliner either. Anyway, that's the only issue I had with it.
I've always thought all along that the intent of this legislation was to have any municipality that chose to do it to bear the burden of the cost. So I'd be very receptive to any proposals that clarify that in any way. My understanding from the fiscal notes is that that's already going to be in there. If that isn't clear, I'd be happy to work with the committee to make it.
Mr. Taylor.
This is a conceptual amendment because of the revenue concerns of the chair and others. We probably should put something in here in light of the work we did on the corrections legislation last year to allow these ladies to pay some of the cost of housing them by allowing them a work release program.
I thought you were going to say something about prison industries. But, okay. Do we have anybody else here to testify on this legislation?
This is one of these bills that's easy to go down here.
Hey, Sherry, would you care to join us? Is there anybody else in the audience besides Sherry? Okay. Sherry?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sherry Gall. I represent the Alaska Women's Lobby, and I come before you today to oppose the passage of House Bill 28. We believe that in the last few years we've seen a move in the mood of the legislature to go away from mandatory minimum sentencing and presumptive sentencing, and to move further towards the need for judicial discretion in sentencing. So therefore, we believe that it would be a mistake at this time to grant municipalities the ability to impose mandatory minimum sentences, something that they are not granted under the municipal code at this time. And my understanding is that during the revisions to the municipal code in the last legislature, it was only then that the limit on the amount of sentence that could be placed on an ordinance was raised from 30 days to 90 days. And that was something that was deliberated for a long time, whether to allow municipalities to impose sentences as long as 90 days. And now we're talking about allowing municipalities to impose minimum sentences, minimum mandatory sentences. Currently under state law, mandatory minimum sentences are available for murder in the first and second degree and DWI and driving with a suspended license. It seems that mandatory minimum sentences are quite a strong punitive measure. There is no exception to the mandatory minimum, and even presumptive sentences include aggravating and mitigating circumstances. We believe that the passage of this legislation will result in the mandatory incarceration of women who sell their sexual services, but it doesn't focus on those who exploit these women. And if anything, it seems as if passage of this legislation will increase the pimps' control and power over the prostitutes, because they will have even more need for having someone to help protect them from the law. I know that the committee substitute addresses those who pay for the services of a prostitute, and in the past, the Alaska Women's Lobby has supported proposed changes in the state statutes to include this crime in the interest of equal protection. But we don't find that the inclusion of patrons of prostitutes in this particular bill makes this bill more desirable. And we feel that if imposed penalties are to be imposed, then the focus of those increased penalties should be on those who promote prostitution and exploit prostitutes. And we really feel that focus needs to be directed at the problem of underage prostitutes, both male and female, and those adults who encourage and exploit these youth. Attention needs to be directed at those who knowingly solicit the services of underage prostitutes. We would respectfully submit that perhaps municipalities might want to instead consider the option of decriminalization and regulation as a means to deal with the problems associated with prostitution, such as the public health risks of sexually transmitted diseases and the nuisance factors in the neighborhoods of the garish neon signs associated with this industry. And we feel that the court should then deal with the more serious criminal aspects of child prostitution. Thank you for considering these views.
Thank you, Sherry. Is there any questions from the committee? Representative Taylor.
Yeah, I read through your position paper, and what you just said. Is the Alaska Women's Commission
It's the Women's Lobby, I represent.
The Women's Lobby, I'm sorry. Is it supporting the decriminalization of prostitution? Is that what you're saying?
I say that if one is considering that prostitution, no, I would say I'm not taking a stand on decriminalization at this point, but I think that if the municipalities feel they want to consider a way to get a handle on problems associated with prostitution, that would be one way.
I put in a bill, you know, for gambling here a couple of weeks ago, but I didn't think I'd have any support for a prostitution bill. So,
are you suggesting that otherwise you would have put one in? Huh?
Well, I don't know. I'm seriously going to think about it. Maybe we can help out with another.
I knew it.
Another tourist attraction. Representative Donnelly? I'm sorry, there wasn't anybody else to testify, is there? Okay, we're just going to go to 3 o'clock. Do you want to testify? Is there any other questions of Sherry?
Well, a quick one that's related to...
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's been some proposals put forth that we may want to incorporate within this legislation some sort of requirement that if someone is convicted of the crime of prostitution, that there be a mandatory testing for any communicable diseases required. And that might address some of the health concerns that have been raised by the witness, and I just wonder if the witness would support that sort of amendment to the legislation. Just a question.
I guess I would support things that would lead to safety factors in public health, but I guess I am afraid that I don't believe that allowing municipalities the ability to impose mandatory minimum sentences is something that we can support.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yeah, I assume this bill is going to be held over also so we can work on this. But I would like to, at the appropriate time, offer an amendment that will include within this any pimping activities, too. I assume you would support that. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to take one more person's testimony here very quickly, if we could. This time. Okay, and then we're going to hold this bill till Friday's calendar.
We're going to have some amendments or committee substitutes.
Whatever the committee wishes. Do you identify yourself, sir?
Yeah, my name is Ed McGrath. I'm not representing anybody. I'm just a resident of the state. And I came here to say that I'd like to encourage you to encourage municipalities, if they want to deal with prostitution, to deal with it in a more civilized way than merely putting prostitutes in jail. All over the world, prostitution is dealt with in one way or another. It's not going to be gotten rid of in the state of Alaska. it might be gotten rid of in the Spinard area if things get tough enough there, but it'll only move to another part of the city. Prostitution is always going to be with us, and I don't think that this approach of putting people in jail is going to change anything. In fact, I think that if you're going to do anything about this, you ought to attempt to remove violence from the situation. And this may do the opposite, as the last testifier just said, by increasing the control of pimps. They're responsible for a lot of violence. Also, the more criminal the activity is, the less the participants have recourse to the judicial system in cases of theft from customers by prostitutes, and in cases of violence against prostitutes by customers. I myself have no problem with saying I'd like to see it decriminalized and operated more like it is in Amsterdam, which is a really civilized place when it comes to prostitution. There, the women run their own business. They don't have to pay off the police. They don't have to have pimps to protect them. There are police strolling through the area, making sure that no violence is going to occur with the customers. And I think that if you want to criminalize prostitution and make people go to jail for it, it comes from some moral ground. I'd like to see it looked at from a practical ground, thinking that it's going to be with us. Let's make sure that it doesn't cause any problems for anyone. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Mr. Grunberg.
Yeah, Mr. McGrath, just one question. Do you know what plans the Dutch authorities and others have to have at the present time to deal with the AIDS problem in this area? How they're going to deal with that if it's unregulated, or are they going to take some particular steps to ensure that AIDS is not transmitted more readily than it would otherwise be?
Well, I believe that it is regulated, and that the prostitutes are licensed and required to have semi-weekly checkups, medical exams. Also, because because there's no rush and there's no hurry, there's a public education side to it too. The prostitutes are well aware of the danger of AIDS, and have no qualms about running through a procedure and making sure they're protecting themselves. I mean, it isn't the loose scene where it's done in cars and on the fly and avoiding people seeing and staying away from the police and all. It's much more controlled. They approach it sort of like a social scientist or something.
I've heard it described anyway.
Any other questions of Mr. McGrath? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. This committee is rolling right into last year's agenda. I don't think we ever got a bill out in one day last year, and so we'll hold this till, I believe, the PERC chart here, critical flow, is on Friday, and people can work on it, I guess, whichever way they want to. And I am going to ask the Division of Corrections for a new fiscal note, or at least to explain their zero fiscal note when they testified to this committee that they were only collecting $35 a day from the municipality. It was costing them about $70 to house prisoners. How they can expect to get more municipal prisoners this way and still have a zero fiscal impact. So just for the committee's information, I'll write that letter under my own letterhead and get that. Okay, we're adjourned.